All right, let's try that again.
Good evening and welcome to Destinies. I'm Howard Margolin, and tonight the voice of science fiction presents part one of Homer A. Chickum Jr.'s Back to the Moon, read by Boyd Gaines on the Destinies audiobook sampler. Christopher DePalippis returns with his list of the best and worst reads of 2006 in volume 2, number 65 of De Flipside. And we'll shine the Destinies soundtrack spotlight on Henry Mancini and Michael Kamen's score for the 1985 film Life Force, beginning with main title, The Life Force Theme.
Welcome everyone, I'm Christopher DeFilippis, and this is The Flipside. Coming straight at you from the deepest, darkest stacks is my annual list of best and worst reads. As usual, I'll be counting down my top 5 books, the best short story, and the worst read of the year. Remember, the books listed weren't necessarily published in 2006, hence the title Best Reads instead of Best Books. On with the picks for 2006. Book 5, In the Garden of Eden by Cage Baker. This is the first of Cage Baker's novels about Dr. Zeus Incorporated, otherwise known as The Company, an organization that recruits time travelers to track lost bits of history and preserve them for future discovery and profit. The problem is that the company has grown so powerful that nobody seems to know who's running it or to what ends. Garden of Eden tells the story of company operative Mendoza, from her recruitment as a small child where she faced certain death at the hands of the Spanish Inquisition in 16th century Spain, her training and augmentation by the company, which transforms its operatives into immortal cyborgs, and her first assignment among the mortal humans she has come to disdain and fear. But once arrived in Renaissance England to collect long-extinct plants, Mendoza finds that the 16th century is worse than she remembers and better than she imagined. Baker is a better writer than I thought at first because I was 2/3 of the way through Garden of Eden before I realized I'd been sucked into a romance novel. But by that time, I was past caring. Interesting characters, rich historical settings, and a plot which hinges on a highly entertaining science fiction time travel premise make Garden of Eden a winner. I can't wait to see what else Cage Baker's company novels have in store. Book 4, The Atrocity Archives by Charles Stross. I reviewed the Atrocity Archives on air last year. Since then, Charles Stross's reputation has grown as quickly as his celebrated body of work. The Atrocity Archives serves as a great indoctrination for those as yet unacquainted with Strauss's witty and sophisticated style. It presents a world where magic, governed by mathematical precepts, can be used as long as the proper safeguards are in place. Ensuring those safeguards is Bob Howard, who works for the super-secret British intelligence agency, The Laundry. After years of humdrum work as a laundry IS tech, Bob has been approved for active duty in the counter-possession unit. His first field assignment brings him to America, where he has to contact a British expatriate professor working in California. But what begins as a simple fact-gathering mission becomes more complicated when the professor is kidnapped by a Middle East terrorist cell working magic of a dangerous magnitude, last used by the Third Reich during World War II. Part horror, part spy thriller, and liberally peppered with wry English humor, The Atrocity Archives pulls off the neat trick of being at once complex and breezy. The story is detailed and multi-layered, but never loses its sense of immediacy or accessibility. Whether Stross is writing for laughs, shocks, or thrills, his prose is always pitch perfect. The Atrocity Archives is a smart and clever book brimming with interesting characters, humor, creativity, and weird, intelligent fun. Book 3, The Book of Flying by Keith Miller. Lyrical is the word that most readily describes Miller's style. The Book of Flying presents the story of Pico, a lonely librarian and poet who lives in the city by the sea, and who has fallen in love with a girl who can fly. But when her affections become estranged from earthbound Pico, he locks up his library and embarks on a quest to find the mythical Book of Flying, so he can get wings and win her back. A diverse cast of characters colors his travels, including a robber queen, a lonely minotaur, a studious rabbit, and a dream seller, all of which temper Pico's perceptions of love, loss, and himself. The Book of Flying is best characterized as an adult fairy tale, and as such, it is poignant and moving and, dare I say it, enchanting. If you're a fan of fanciful prose and feel, as I do, that beautiful writing can be an end unto itself, then The Book of Flying is the book for you. Book 2, The Jennifer Morgue by Charles Stross. Wait, you're saying, didn't he just tell us about Charles Stross? Yes, I did, and I'm going to do it again. The Jennifer Morgue is the sequel to The Atrocity Archives, and as much as I loved those initial adventures of laundry operative Bob Howard, I loved their continuation in The Jennifer Morgue even more. When a billionaire businessman attempts to dredge a rather nasty bit of ancient alien technology up from the sea floor, Bob Howard is on the case. But he soon becomes entangled, both figuratively and literally, with CIA Black Chamber operative Ramona Random, and is snared in a magical trap that sets him on a seemingly predetermined path toward disaster. Bob is forced to roll with the spell that is apparently dictating his actions from without, while fighting within to stave off the succubus that inhabits Ramona. And did I mention the zombie seagulls? Stross has really hit his stride with The Jennifer Morgue. The story is suspenseful, rollicking, and hilarious. It's Ian Fleming meets Douglas Adams meets Die Hard with a vengeance. And I especially recommend it to you Bond fans out there. You'll love this book, since a deconstruction and re-examination of the Bond mythos is essential to the plot. Trust me on this. And if, like me, you're not especially a Bond fan, you'll love it anyway. I cannot speak highly enough about The Jennifer Morgue. Which naturally leads you to ask, why is it only book two? What could possibly trump it? The answer surprises me as much as it will probably surprise you. My number one read of 2006 is Misery by Stephen King. For the record, I stopped reading Stephen King more than a decade ago after slogging through the 1,000-plus page Needful Things to an extremely unsatisfying end. I haven't read any of his new books since and probably never will. But I found an old copy of Misery lying around the cafeteria at work and decided it couldn't be the worst way of whiling away my lunch hour. Well, it was like coming home. Here was the King I remembered, the King who had given me It and Pet Sematary and, above all, The Shining. Even if you haven't read the book, you probably already know the story from the movie starring James Caan and Kathy Bates. Best-selling author Paul Sheldon is rescued from a near-fatal car crash by his biggest fan, the deranged and murderous Annie Wilkes. When Annie finds out that Paul has killed off her favorite fictional character, romance heroine Misery Chastain, she keeps Paul prisoner and forces him to write a new book chronicling Misery's triumphant return. Filled with the horror, gore, and compelling characters that were once King's trademarks, Misery deserves to be counted among the author's best works. But what makes it really stand out for me, and what eventually nudged it just a hair over the Jennifer Morgue to take the top spot on this list, is its exploration of the writing process itself. If you've ever wondered what it's really like to be a writer, the highs, the lows, the insecurities, the triumphs, or just the plain old daily process, Misery will give you as near to first-hand experience as you can get without actually penning a novel yourself. And if you are a writer, like me, Misery will speak to your very soul, melodramatic as that sounds. You will empathize tremendously with Paul Sheldon because it will be as if you're reading about yourself. Just to give you the flavor, here's one of my favorite lines. He didn't need a psychiatrist to point out that writing had its autoerotic side. You beat a typewriter instead of your meat, but both acts depended largely on quick wits, fast hands, and a heartfelt commitment to the art of the far-fetched. True words were never written, and for speaking to me so directly and honestly, Misery earns the distinction as my top read in 2006. Next up is my best short story, The Word of Unbinding by Ursula K. Le Guin. This is the first story set in what would become Le Guin's Earthsea universe. It explores how magic works in Earthsea, following the trials of the wizard Festin, who has been imprisoned by an evil mage. It is a simple story that nonetheless embodies the deeper themes that would come to dominate the Earthsea books, chiefly the value of patience and self-sacrifice, both of which are brilliantly and movingly displayed in the story's tragic last line, which leads us to tragedy of a different sort, the worst read of 2006. This year, the prize goes to a dismally boring book called Babylon by Richard Calder. I made the oldest mistake in the game with this book. I got sucked in by its cover, an 1836 painting by artist Thomas Cole called The Course of Empire, Destruction. Turns out that Cole's gripping canvas was the most compelling thing about the book, which surprised me because the plot had potential, including, as it did, such diverse elements as two novitiates in a society of whores, access to a parallel earth where it is always night, and Jack the Ripper. And let's not forget the Black Order, the Thule Society, and genocide. Despite all that, the book can most effectively be summed up in one word: tedious. Steer clear of Richard Calder's Babylon, unless, of course, you'd like to make an offer on my signed, numbered first edition. If anything, it'll look handsome in your collection. So there you have it, the best and worst books I read in 2006. This year's list holds the distinction as the first ever where one author took two spots. Nice going, Charlie. All in all, though, it was a mixed year for books. Of the 20 I read, I rated 9 books good to excellent, while another 9 fell in the fair to middling range. Despite this, there were only 2 real turkeys, and the books that were really good, so that made up for the rest. As always, if you read any of these books based on my recommendations, please email me and let me know what you think. The email address is cdeflip@yahoo.com. That's cdeflip@yahoo.com. And if you have any titles of your own to recommend, I am all ears. There's always room on the shelf for one more.
Schuster Audio presents Back to the Moon, written by Homer H. Hickam, Jr., read by Boyd Gaines, with an introduction by the author.
Colwood, West Virginia, my hometown, was not a place where children often looked at the stars. The narrow swath of sky between our mountains only allowed us a peek at the heavens, and even that was often blotted out by the dust and smoke coming from the coal mine tipple. The people of Colwood, dedicated to the industry of coal mining, tended to look down, not up. That all changed for me when I was in the fourth grade. After reading everything on the grade school bookshelves, I started going upstairs to the junior high library, and there I discovered the wonderful novels of Jules Verne, Heinlein, Asimov, Van Vogt, Clark, and Bradbury. These writers challenged me to look up at the sky and to imagine myself crossing the boundless frontier of the universe. In the fall of 1957, when I was in the 10th grade, Sputnik was launched, and a great space race began between the United States and Russia. Because of the science fiction I'd read, I thought I already knew something of spaceflight, and began to build and launch my own rockets, much to the consternation of the good citizens of Colwood. I eventually fulfilled my boyhood dreams and secured a position as an engineer with the National Aeronautics and Space Administration. I had become, I thought, an engineer dedicated to the pursuit of science and exploration, just like the men in the novels I'd read in childhood. The space shuttle era was just beginning when I started at NASA. It was an exciting time for engineers, scientists, and astronauts in the space agency as we learned how to fly and operate a manned, heavy-lift spacecraft with wings. The space shuttle proved to be a magnificent machine, capable of accomplishing a wide variety of tasks in space. But as the years passed, I began to notice an increasing frustration among my fellow NASA engineers. The fact was, most of us had signed on to explore space, to go to the moon, to the planets, and beyond. The space shuttle was designed for the routine task of people and cargo hauling into low Earth orbit. It was almost as if, after the Apollo flights, there had been a directive from on high. The moon and the planets were off limits to astronauts. All they were allowed to do was carve endless loops around the Earth in the space shuttle and maybe, someday, aboard an international space station. The astronauts might have been satisfied with that directive, but not so NASA engineers. Many of us especially thought we should build on Apollo and go back to the moon. One day, a paper written by Jim Baker, a Rockwell shuttle engineer, fell into my hands. In it was a proposal for modifying an existing space shuttle to fly to the moon, orbit around it, and return to the Earth. I called Jim, and we discussed his idea at length. Yes, he said, it could be done. All that it required was the will to go and do it. Many years passed, but Baker's ideas stuck with me. I often found myself lurking in the techno-thriller or science fiction areas of bookstores, looking unsuccessfully for a novel about a realistic spacecraft, maybe even the shuttle, going back to the moon. I never found it. One day, it occurred to me that if I wanted to read such a book, I would have to write it myself. About the same time, I began to hear about a very special isotope called helium-3. Helium-3, a source of almost limitless energy, is rare on Earth, but abundant on the Moon. I found it both ironic and hopeful that mankind's survival on our relatively lush planet may very well depend on the airless, desolate Moon. It is said that heroes are made by the challenges they confront, by the risks they take, and by the pain they endure. These are all necessary to get the characters of Back to the Moon to live up to the book's title. This reflects reality. The Apollo missions pushed the edge of a technological envelope, and to go back to the moon today would still be difficult and risky. Nevertheless, many of my colleagues at NASA share my belief that we need to go now, without delay. The moon is laden with a vast storehouse of treasure that this country and the world will need in the very near future. If we aren't willing to take on the challenge of securing it, we will perhaps doom our planet to a limited and painful future that won't allow spaceflight at all. Then it will be too late. Let's not risk it. We need to go back to the moon. All that is required is the will and the courage to do it. Thank you.
On December 12, 1972, Apollo 17 astronaut Gene Cernan was having the time of his life on the moon. Driving the lunar rover over the powdery regolith was simply too much fun not to bust loose now and then. When he hit a bump and the rover's front wheels left the ground, he let out a whoop. Then he spotted a dune and, rather than steering away, headed straight for it. The rover dug in, its wheels gaining traction. Cernan, grinning like a school kid, looked over at his partner, Harrison Jack Schmidt, who kept his eyes straight ahead, stoic as always. The rover bounced as it went over the top of the dune, its wire wheels spinning. Cernan spotted a large crater off to the left. He heard Schmidt's voice crackle in his helmet headset. "I want to go over to Shorty." Cernan marveled that Schmidt had memorized the name of every crater in the Taurus-Littrow region. "Okay, Jack, we're on our way." He made a quick turn and pushed the joystick throttle forward. "Be advised, you are near red line on consumables, Gene." Houston Mission Control crackled in the headsets of both astronauts. Cernan switched to crew-only communication, or COM. "You heard the man, Jack. We've got just enough oxygen to get back to the LEM." Cernan heard Schmidt's exasperated sigh. "That's if we had to walk back, Gene, and you know that's not going to happen. The rover's in good shape. I really need to take a look at Shorty. Make a bunch of geologists happy if I did. It's a bit of a mystery." Cernan weighed the odds. If anything happened to the rover, he and Schmidt would run out of oxygen before they could make it back to the LEM on foot. The LEM, or Lunar Module, was their home on the moon and their ride back up to Ron Evans, who waited for them in the Apollo command module orbiting the moon. But Schmidt was the only scientist ever to walk on this cold surface. He needed every precious second he could get for his research. It was the last time men were going to be on the moon for many years. Maybe it was time to play the odds. Cernan stopped the lunar dune buggy at the base of the steep crater rim. "This dude, Jack?" Schmidt made no reply, not a second to waste. He hopped out and headed up the slope in as near a run as his suit would allow. Cernan detached the television camera from the rover so he could show Houston the view and trudged up the crumbling slope. The view up there was, by God, beautiful. Undulating sand mountains lay like white porcelain sculptures in a vast gray ocean of dust. Schmidt hustled over to a boulder which was coated with black dust.
"I'm beside a boulder that has a knobby surface and is covered with hairline cracks," Schmidt reported to the boys in the geologist's back room and then laughed. "I've just solved in less than a minute an argument that's been raging in the geology world for years. Some of the boys say that Shorty's volcanic. Others say a meteor caused it. Well, I know exactly what it is now."
"Then tell the world, Jack."
Cernan worked his way over to his partner and filled the television frame with him.
"Shorty is a fresh impact crater," Schmidt observed succinctly. "There's an accumulation of basaltic spatter and cinders. Shorty's floor appears to be either impact-indurated soil breccia or the top of the subfloor basalt."
But Mission Control seemingly had a one-track mind.
"You should be heading back to the LEM now."
Schmidt, however, was stubborn.
"I want a soil sample."
Cernan tried not to betray his own anxiety. Hypoxia was not an easy way to die.
"We gotta go, Jack."
Cernan was the commander. He could order Schmidt back on the rover, but there was something about Shorty Crater that made Cernan want to push the envelope. He relented.
"Make it fast, Jack."
Schmidt puttered around the site, taking samples and gravity readings. Houston kept calling Cernan and reminding him that they were at the limit of their walk-back capability, and Cernan kept replying that he knew it. Just another minute more and they'd be out of there.
"Oh, hey, wait a minute. There's orange soil here."
Schmidt's excited voice was an octave higher than usual.
"I've got to see how big it is."
Schmidt bounded back to the rover to the storage box, got out a rake, and trudged back to the splotch.
"Orange soil is consistent with oxidized iron, Gene. This indicates volcanic activity, but everything else about Shorty points to an impact crater. We haven't solved a mystery at all. We've just created one. We've got to get some samples back."
Schmidt filled some sample bags. Cernan looked at his gauges. If the rover conked out,
They were dead men.
Let's go, Jack.
Still need a core sample. Schmidt puffed and picked up the drive tube he had brought from the box. Then Cernan heard him say, I forgot the hammer. Houston made another call, this one a command to get in the rover now and head back to the lunar module. With both time and air running out, Cernan went back to the rover, dug through the tools, but couldn't find the hammer. He grabbed the next best thing, a cylindrical canister capped on both ends. He had no idea what it was or why it was in the tool bag, but he didn't care. The soil was hard, and Cernan had to use the canister to pound the drive tube with both hands. He dropped the canister, grabbed the sample tube, and rocked it back and forth until it loosened enough to be pulled out. Schmidt reached for it.
Even the tube is orange.
Cernan looked once more at the gauges on the front of his suit. All the needles were pointing south.
Come on,
he said, scuttling back to the rover. He unlatched the sample box and stowed the precious orange-coated drive tube inside. If the rover held together, if the oxygen gauges were correct, and if they didn't get lost on the way back, they could make it. Plumes of lunar dust from the rover wheels erupted behind them as the last two men on the moon made a desperate run against the clock.
In the background is Henry Mancini's theme from Life Force, and after the flip side, we heard London in Chaos, composed and conducted by Michael Kamen. The expanded 2-CD soundtrack of Life Force is available as a limited edition of 3,000 units from www.buysoundtracks.com. That's www.buysoundtracks.com. On January 26th, we'll bring you part two of Back to the Moon and a soundtrack spotlight on Philip Glass's score for Roving Mars in our 22nd annual salute to the crews of the space shuttles Challenger and Columbia. In 2 weeks, we'll be preempted by WUSB's semi-annual Reggae Marathon. The Voice of Science Fiction will be back on February 9th with a new installment of The Flip Side. As Destiny's 20s continue, listen for interviews with T.A. Barron and John Kenneth Muir, soundtrack spotlight salutes to composers Basil Poladouris and Shirley Walker, episodes of Spider-Man, Suspense, and Fantastic Four on the Destiny's Radio Theater, and concerts by the Brobdingnagian Bards and Emerald Rose. To offer your comments about our program or to request copies of this or any previous broadcast, you can write to Destiny's, care of WUSB-FM, Stony Brook University, Stony Brook, New York, 11794. Or you can call me at 631-632-6901. That's 632-6901 on Wednesdays after 8 p.m. You can also send email to destinysvoice@aol.com. That's destinysvoice@aol.com. Destinies is produced by members and friends of the Stony Brook Science Fiction Forum in association with WUSB. The forum is located in rooms 020 and 029 in Harriman Hall on the Stony Brook University campus. For information about meetings and other forum activities, call 631-632-6598. That's 632-6598. To hear archived Destiny shows, including our 2004 Shuttle Memorial, featuring an interview with the late Hal Clement, visit www.captphilonline.com. That's www.captphilonline.com. Or go to https://podcast.ic.sunysb.edu/weblog/destinies. That's https://podcast.ic.sunysb.edu/weblog/destinies. Tonight's show is dedicated to the memory of Yvonne DiCarlo, who died of natural causes at the age of 84 on January 8th in Los Angeles. Best remembered for her role as Lily Munster in the 1964 to 1966 TV series The Munsters, DiCarlo also played Zipporah, the wife of Moses, in the 1956 epic film The Ten Commandments. She appeared in such science fiction, adventure, and horror movies as The Power, The Mark of Zorro, Satan's Cheerleaders, Nocturna, Silent Scream, Vultures, Play Dead, American Gothic, Cellar Dweller, and Mirror Mirror, and made guest appearances on episodes of Lights Out, The Girl from U.N.C.L.E., Fantasy Island, and Tales from the Crypt. Until next Friday at 11:30 p.m., when we'll honor the memories of the crews of Challenger and Columbia with part two of Back to the Moon and music from Roving Mars. For Christopher DeFilippis, this is Howard Margolin wishing you the best of all possible destinies.
is Quentin Crisp. You're listening to WUSB Stony Brook.